Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. How does science advance? When theories are discarded, who looks over the scrap heap to pan for what might have been good ideas with poor execution or take the thinking in a new direction? Further, don't we know everything already about human anatomy, at least on the macroscopic level? My guest today, doctor and writer Brett Stetka, has excellent answers to these questions. As far as the anatomy question, Stetka reported on a finding of a newly discovered circulatory system in the brain, first in mice, then in humans, all in 2015, and I thought I learned it all in med school. As far as scientific advancement in general, Stetka writes at the intersection of brain science, neurology, psychiatry, and evolutionary theory. Fascinating stuff. Take, for example, the notion that inflammation is a key driver of poor health, leading to everything from cardiovascular disease to mental illness, cancer, and dementia. Turns out scientists from a century ago weren't so far off in their theories. They just didn't have the tools of molecular biology that we have now to help point them in the right direction. As a result, they often got sidetracked down ill-fated rabbit holes. Today, we'll look at some of Stetka's articles for NPR's health blog, Shots, as well as some pieces he's written for Scientific American. We'll tour ideas for preventing mental illness in utero and move all the way to cancer immunology, but we'll avoid the hype. Dr. Writer Brett Stetka is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Brett Stetka, welcome to the program. Let's start by talking about your most recent piece for the NPR website. It's called Shots, their health blog, and the title is Can Mental Illness Be Prevented in the Womb? I thought this was really interesting. We know that probably a fifth of the population has a diagnosable mental illness, but this refers specifically, though, to serious mental illness, the kind that's disabling, things such as schizophrenia or severe bipolar disorder. And you tell us, what did the research that you're highlighting show, and what are the questions? And can mental illness be prevented in the womb?
Yeah, it's a good question. And so this all started in Colorado. There's a researcher named Robert Freeman, who's a psychiatrist and an editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry. And he oversaw the department that had treated the teenager that unfortunately shot a bunch of people in a movie theater a few years ago in Aurora, Colorado. And that really sparked an interest. He was like, you know, we have to do something about the severe cases of mental illness. And, you know, typically the mentally ill are not any more prone to committing violence than anyone. But with these really, you know, terrible tragedies that keep happening, these mass shootings, there often is mental illness at play. So this inspired Dr. Freeman to think about how can we prevent mental illness early on in a child's life, as opposed to waiting until symptoms present and then treating, which is typically how psychiatry works. It's not really a preventative discipline. And through his basic science research, he was able to identify a receptor in the brain that is mutated and expressed as highly in the brains of schizophrenic people that is actually stimulated by the B vitamin choline in the womb of a pregnant woman. And so choline is really essential to brain development, to normal neuronal signaling. And so what he thought was, just like we, you know, doctors give folate to pregnant women to prevent spina bifida and spinal cord defects, he thought perhaps if we supplement pregnant women with choline to make sure they're getting enough of this essential vitamin, maybe this could reduce the incidence of mental health in their kids. And he did show that in a study of 100 moms that were supplemented with choline at twice the amount recommended. 4 years down the road, these kids had significantly less attention problems, less behavioral problems, and really the attention and behavioral problems predict the future development of mental illness, specifically schizophrenia. So it was pretty powerful data, and there's a couple of other studies showing that too, that in moms that have adequate or even high choline levels in their blood, there is a far reduced incidence of mental illness in their children. So it's early, and there's only been a few studies, but it's something that I think most psychiatrists or psychiatrists that are aware of this connection think is definitely worth, you know, looking into and researching further.
So let's, I just want to highlight a couple of things you mentioned. For one thing, you mentioned folate, and I think since we have a good general listenership, it's important to remind people or teach that folate, folic acid as it's also called, is now put in staples like bread. So right. That the general population, folate is a vitamin that you really can't get too much of, but science has been well figured out that something called neural tube defects, which is a form of embryologic, you know, in utero type of malformation, like, and can lead to conditions like spina bifida. So mm-hmm. By supplementing with folate, our food with folate, we greatly lessen those types of birth defects. So similarly here, Dr. Friedman thought if we give choline to pregnant women, we could reduce the risk of downstream mental illness. And so these, we need to reiterate, these are very preliminary studies, but you seem to have a finger on the pulse of this, these scientific findings. I mean, is this something that's going to be replicated in a larger scale and possibly, you know, taken to the, you know, the U.S. FDA for, you know, a recommended daily allowance of choline? I mean, there is already an RDA, but would we want to recommend a higher dose in pregnant women, I guess, is the question. How long does that process generally take?
It takes a while, and Dr. Freeman was quick to point out that while his study was funded by the federal government, it's very hard to get these types of studies funded in the current state of things. But that said, there are a lot of researchers, including Freeman, that are continuing with this work. There's a woman at Columbia and Catherine Monk, who's studying the effects of choline supplementation. There's an OB colleague of Freeman's at the University of Colorado that's looking into this and recommends it to her patients. And it appears that there's really no severe side effects or developmental problems in children exposed to choline, unless we're talking about extremely high doses, way, way higher than even, you know, even supplements have. So I think it's something that we're going to see OBs and psychiatrists recommending, you know, cautiously, but more frequently. And hopefully there'll be funding available for this, because I think, like I wrote about in my piece, ideally these studies would be 20 to 25 years, because, you know, that's when schizophrenia tends to emerge. So if Dr. Freeman can get the funding to follow these children, not just for 4 years, but all the way out to 20, if they're still available to participate, then we would know a lot more. But yeah, until then, I think these studies will continue to trickle out and be replicated, and, you know, hopefully this will pan out. And just like folate, it's a very simple intervention that does not seem to have really any severe side effects.
So, right. So again, the caveat, not enough research, enough number of patients to know this works for sure, and certainly not a long enough follow-up period. We, you know, I guess at 4 to 7 years, we want to see this, as you quote Freeman in the article, another 20 to 25 years to see if full-blown mental illness develops. So interestingly, almost exactly a year ago, you wrote another very interesting piece for the NPR health blog Shots. This one was titled, Could Depression Be Caused by an Infection? So similar theme in the sense that a mental illness that we think of as being caused at this point, I guess our best guess is there's a genetic component and then environmental stimuli that may trigger, and then, of course, biological factors. We don't know. And one area that you're interested in is the microbiome, that is the bacteria that live in our gut, as a possible trigger to mental illness. But this was an article asking, could depression be caused by an infection, where you tied back to the history of a doctor named Adolf Meyer, who thought that, in fact, pulling out rotting teeth or teeth with cavities could, in fact, cure or prevent mental illness. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Meyer and what the modern spin on this is.
Yeah, so Adolf Meyer was an interesting, somewhat extreme doctor, lived in New Jersey in the early part of the 1900s, and he had this idea that mental illness was caused by lingering infections in people, namely in their teeth. So he began removing teeth in his depressive patients and his schizophrenic patients, and reported some degree of success. And then when that didn't work in particular people, he started excising tonsils, testicles, colons, these rather extreme surgeries that caught on for a period of time as kind of a high society trendy cure for mental illness. He had a pretty successful clinic, and I think did pretty well. But eventually the science caught up with these rather extreme, crazy ideas, and he, you know, stopped practicing, and this sort of fell out of favor. But over 100 years later, the idea that infection linked with mental illness is back again, and really it all comes down to inflammation, sort of overactivity of the immune system, which can be caused in some cases by infection or by genetic predispositions, by a lot of factors, stress, lack of sleep. So it's probably fair to say, according to some researchers, that in a subset of patients with mental illness, infection could have triggered it or could contribute to it. And I think most researchers in this area would agree that inflammation definitely plays a very important role in certain mental illnesses.
My guest is Brett Stetka. He's a doctor turned editor and writer with Medscape by WebMD. And he's also a freelance writer and has written for such publications as The Atlantic and Wired, and Scientific American, and several pieces for the NPR health blog, Shots. And Brett, we were talking about the sort of historical theory, anyway, that infection could lead to depression or mental illness. And that fell out of favor, as you point out, because there was really not science behind that. But now, a century later, we have a deeper understanding of how inflammation, not specifically from an infection, but could be caused by an infection, the body's own immune system ramped up, can be causative of these types of disorders or disturbances in the brain or brain chemistry. One of the things you wrote, or actually a couple of different pieces in Scientific American in 2015, on the perhaps what you said were some of the most important neurologic findings of 2015, which was a link between the brain and the immune system. For a long time, scientists and doctors have thought about this mythic blood-brain barrier. That is, that it's very hard to get medication, antibiotics, and other things into the brain because of really tight cellular junctions that don't allow this to occur. But scientists have sort of found this is not exactly true.
That's right. So yeah, for years we've, you know, in medical school, yourself and myself learned about this blood-brain barrier being so impenetrable, and the brain was typically thought of being, you know, quote-unquote immunoprivileged, meaning that it really didn't have much of a connection with the immune system, which was thought to be a protective mechanism. So if we get an infection, you know, our immune system ratchets up and there's all this inflammation and it's this powerful response that the brain was thought to be too vulnerable to. So it was like, let's keep all this immune activity out of our brains. But last year, 2015, a group at the University of Virginia led by Joni Kipnis uncovered basically a new part of the body. They discovered a series of lymphatic vessels that connect the brain basically to the immune system. So this is a way that immune molecules or immune cells and factors can reach the brain. And it was really pretty striking, one, because it's a whole new piece of anatomy, but two, it could explain how autoimmune disorders affect the brain, such as multiple sclerosis, autism, and even Alzheimer's are thought to have an autoimmune component in some people. So this could explain how the immune system in some cases can attack the brain, how it can reach it. And it really changes the whole dogma of how we thought about neuroanatomy.
Well, so that's so interesting just right off the bat, which is that these researchers discovered this sort of new anatomical feature. I mean, don't we know everything about the human body already?
Yeah, it was assumed we probably knew. We'd mapped every single part of the body. I think they may have discovered a new layer of the eye or something a few years ago, but this was you know, really one of the first new pieces of anatomy to be discovered in a long, long time.
So how did they do it exactly?
I believe they started in mice, and through some staining process, one of Dr. Kipnis's colleagues just noticed that the brain had this series of vessels that he was unaware of, and, you know, in researching it hadn't been reported, and then, you know, they confirmed that this was, in fact, a lymphatic vessel, and, you know, our body's filled with these what are called lymphatic vessels that return fluid to the bloodstream, so it doesn't just collect in our bodies. And and then they confirmed it in patients that, you know, in humans. So, you know, it turns out the human system has a correlate of this lymphatic system of vessels. And, you know, it's pretty early, but it's presumed that this could have significant ramifications in terms of understanding disorders of the brain and eventually even treating these immune-related conditions like multiple sclerosis, for example.
Just goes to show you can never never be pat, you know. You just got to keep pushing, keep pushing the envelope. Well, so something else that you wrote really stuck out to me, which was staying on the topic of brain optimization, if you will, in search of the optimal brain diet. And this really caught my eye because, you know, we all want to know, what is the optimal brain diet? So what did you conclude, or what kinds of things did you find?
Well, so I spoke to a lot of neuroscientists, psychiatrists, and an evolutionary biologist, actually. And all signs point to seafood, for one. There's all the healthiest diets in the world, like the Mediterranean diet, the Okinawan diet, the Scandinavian diet. There's a lot of really, really healthy, you know, omega-3 fats from fish and from seaweed and foods from the sea. And that sort of fits the evolutionary backstory of humans. I mean, there's a lot of anthropologists who have confirmed that humans nearly went extinct maybe 150,000 195 to 125,000 years ago, somewhere in there, the human population fell drastically. Some people think to even a few hundred people. And then around that time, our diets drastically seem to have shifted to a more seafood-based diet. And so basically they think in the African Rift Valley, our population had dwindled, and then we started being able to access these shellfish beds along the ocean that were incredibly easy to obtain calories from, because the tide goes out, you just wander out, and there's no hunting involved, you just gather the shellfish. And around that time, humans sort of exploded, and our brains evolved very, very quickly. We obviously outcompeted our other hominid ancestors, and it's thought that seafood and the healthy fats from seafood and other healthy nutrients like iodine, for example, really did spur on human brain development. So that's a correlate with now. A lot of the healthiest diets in the world still contain a lot of seafood, a lot of healthy fats, mixed with whole grains, legumes, vegetables, fruits, like darkly colored fruits. So there's no one diet, but I think if you focus on these ingredients that happen to be in the healthiest diets in the world, it's probably a good thing.
So it's worth pointing out, too, that, I mean, I think culturally, at least in the U.S., we have this phobia of fat. We've been conditioned to think, fat is bad. But many of us now who, read in the popular press about the so-called good fats, the omega-3 fatty acids and that are abundant in fish and shellfish and other foods like that, so that the brain isn't, in fact, encased in, white matter, and that there are these conductive cells along our neurons that are myelin sheaths that are really made from fat. So it is, even though we're conditioned to think from a cardiovascular standpoint, avoidance of fat is good. There definitely are good fats that our body needs in order to repair and maintain healthy cellular function. So I think that's worth pointing out. So I failed to point out this was in Scientific American Mind. So another of the sort of interesting the line of your work. And there's another I want to just touch on, maybe one or two more, for NPR Shots. Earlier this year, you had a piece that's related to this optimal diet. This one was actually interesting from another old and discredited, in a sense, theory that has kind of reemerged, which was fighting cancer by putting tumor cells on a diet. This idea that if we starve tumor cells, we can not necessarily cure cancer, but make the cancer more susceptible to the treatments that we give it. So how did you come across this? And I guess, can you share the science with us of what you found?
Yeah, well, this is something I've been seeing, in the literature a bit recently, this idea of treating cancer through diet, and specifically through what's called a ketogenic diet, which is similar to an Atkins diet. It's very low in sugar, high in fats. And there is data to suggest that it might slow cancer growth pretty considerably. So I looked into it, and it turns out that there was a German physician named Otto Warburg in the 1920s, who noticed that cancer cells don't really prefer generating energy through respiration, through oxygen-based energy metabolism like most cells do. They actually prefer the process of fermentation, the same process that produces beer, wine, and cheese and all that good stuff. So he noticed that they really prefer to ferment glucose or sugar. So the theory and the more modern research has shown this is true. Cancer cells do opt for this, the fermentative metabolism. So the idea is that if you starve a cancer of sugar, so you put a patient on a very low sugar diet, the tumor won't progress as quickly. And again, this is early, but it's been shown in numerous animal studies that this is true. If you put a mouse or a rat with cancer on one of these diets, the tumor tends to progress much more slowly. And, a lot of patients and some doctors swear this is true in humans, though there'll be a lot more evidence of that. But it's something that seems to be very promising. And I talked to a lot of oncologists about this, and even the skeptical ones were like, there's probably something here. It's probably not going to replace chemotherapy or immunotherapy, but it might be a helpful adjunct that would enable patients to have a lower dose of chemo, so not be subjected to so many side effects. So I think there probably is something there, but it'll take a few more years of research to figure out just how to counsel patients on diet.
Do you have any sense, because listeners will be interested in learning more about this, other than reading your articles, if someone was really interested in nutritional therapy for cancer, you know, where to go, where to turn, how to get more information, or where clinically this might be the most relevant?
I would, you know, suggest just talking to their oncologist about it and just presenting the idea. The major cancer centers are certainly looking into it. Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City here where I am, and MD Anderson, they have many, many researchers looking into this idea, into this sort of metabolic theory of cancer, that it's not exclusively a genetic disorder. It's also caused by these cells having this altered metabolism. So I think patients that are at one of these centers can certainly just talk to their oncologist about it. And, you know, if you're out in the community, I would just, present the fact that they're aware of this idea. What does their oncologist know about it? It's one of those decisions that there's no solid data. I doubt most physicians would be like, yes, do this. I'm going to prescribe you this diet. But it's something you discuss with your physician. And if they feel it's safe and the patient is up for it, I feel like that's a positive discussion to be had.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. My guest today is Brett Stetka. He's a doctor turned editor and writer for Medscape by WebMD and a freelance writer of many interesting science and medicine articles for numerous publications. And Brett, I one of the things I really like about your writing is, even though you're writing about what I would call very leading edge theories in terms of brain science and evolution and nutrition and cancer and mental illness for that matter, you do it in a very responsible way where you always, I think, are putting in appropriate caveats. I think it's all too easy because of a sort of our insatiable appetite as a culture for news about health to lapse into, you know, a small study or even an animal study. And then, you know, we see these breathless headlines about, you know, cure for Alzheimer's or cure for cancer. And, we've been disappointed by that really for decades. And so I think you do it in a very thoughtful way that I think really takes your readers on a journey. So, kudos to you for that.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
One other piece I wanted to touch on, this was also for the NPR Health Blog Shots. You wrote about a couple of months back, cancer immunotherapy at a crossroads. And this sort of ties together a number of things. We talked at the outset about possibly, you know, preventing a mental illness in utero, which to me was quite a novel concept. And then from there went to other facts about nutrition and brain science and the optimal brain diet and then brain inflammation and how, in fact, just in 2015, this discovery was made of how the brain may be affected by inflammation. So this was a piece where you reflected on how the science of what's called immunotherapy has really progressed, but we still don't have all the answers. And I guess to put it in a nutshell, we have these monoclonal antibodies. These are these mass-produced immune cells that can go in and target cancer cells with minimal harm to normal tissues. And you talk in the article about tailoring cancer care and a little bit about the history of this and how it's incredibly successful for a small subgroup of patients, but then we still aren't quite there in terms. And you give the example of Jimmy Carter, who had a stage 4 melanoma, and got one of these newer therapies and saw it melt away, but he did actually have to undergo conventional therapy. It was just that the new therapy seemed to set him up for success. So we don't really know why this doesn't work, with 100% efficacy. But what were some of the findings you made there?
Yeah, this is one of those areas. But back to what you were saying about trying to cover these kind of topics responsibly, this is one of those areas that's been getting so much press, and I'm sure I'm guilty of it too. It's very easy to be like, well, immunotherapy is the cure for cancer. It's, we're finding these amazing success rates in conditions like melanoma. But then when you step back, you realize that, for some people, yes, including Jimmy Carter, it's been amazingly successful, but most people still don't respond to a single immunotherapy. So, it's good to be cautious here. One of the doctors I spoke to, I think, said it best. He said, the challenge here is figuring out how to use these new treatments both with each other, with other immunotherapies, and with established therapies like chemo and radiation and targeted treatments. And he said that it's just like chemo. There's really very few cancers out there that are going to respond to one chemotherapy. So when chemo came out, it was the same situation. It's trying to figure out the combinations of regimens. So, I do think that in the next few years, cancer response rates are going to steadily climb thanks to these, and it's going to require figuring out how to use them in concert with chemotherapy and radiation and with each other.
So, Brett, I wanted to ask a little bit about your background. So you're a physician. You went to medical school, and then my understanding is you did a research fellowship and sort of in medical journalism, and then sort of just decided you liked it and stayed, and so didn't wind up going into practice. What was the pathway?
That's right, yeah. I graduated medical school in 2005 from the University of Virginia, and I really didn't know what field I wanted to go in. I really liked the research side of things and wasn't positive I wanted to practice, so rather than entering the residency match, I was accepted to a research and medical writing postdoc at Mount Sinai in a biological psychiatry lab. I was actually studying the effects of red wine in mice, what it did to their risk of Alzheimer's, of mice Alzheimer's, and ended up publishing a number of papers and really, really enjoyed the writing aspect of it. Ended up applying for a job at WebMD, where I'm still an editor, and initially I thought that would also be temporary. Really liked that. And then sort of a side note, at the same time, I started a donut blog. This was 2006, the era when blogs were popping up and everyone thought of food blogs were becoming popular, and I had just moved to New York City. I love food. I was like, I'm going to start a food blog, and sandwiches and donuts were my favorite food. Sandwiches were taken, so I started a donut blog called Blognut and reviewed donuts around town and when I traveled, and oddly, it found some success. I ended up doing a contest with Krispy Kreme and a contest with The Simpsons.
Oh, my goodness, really?
Yeah, it was very unexpected, and it led to a sort of a side food writing gig. I was getting better and better clips and offers to write about food for places. And so I kind of owe my current career more to the donuts than to the research and the scientific publications, because I got better and better clips, and then I was able to pitch these same places health and science stories that probably wouldn't have known my name otherwise if it weren't for the donuts. So I owe a lot to donuts. And it's been 11 years now, and even though I had planned on going back to either practice or to research, I've somehow cobbled together a living as a science editor and writer, and I don't see myself going back at this point.
Well, we have to be clear here. Donuts, not for the optimal brain diet. Clear enough, right?
They're not. I've said this before. They're not an optimal brain diet. They're not cardiovascularly good, but I think they are good for the psyche and the soul.
Fascinating. Is that a blog you still keep up?
I think it is finally defunct. I was paying to keep it up $10 a year, and I didn't pay my fee last year, so it's gone. But there are references to it online. It's called Blognut, if anyone's interested.
Blognut. Well, yeah. Brett Stetka, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great, John. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Brett Stetka is a doctor turned editor and writer for Medscape by WebMD. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.